Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of the Storybox, where I, your host, Jay Phantom, has the utmost privilege and honor to unbox the amazing stories of some incredible people from all walks of life and experiences. I'm delighted and grateful that you're here today. Now let's dive into the story box and hear more about our guest today. All right, my friends, this episode promises to be thick and big because we have the legendary Chris Sheldrick on the story box today. Now, if you don't know who Chris is, he is one of the founders and owners of Thick Cookies, Big Brownies, Banksia in Sydney, and Passion Tree Velvet. Now, if you have not seen Thick Cookies before, these things are insane. Like, they're going to make you hungry just thinking about them right now. And I highly encourage you to go on Instagram, type Thick Cookies, look at these things, and go and order some, because I guarantee you won't go wrong. Chris and I get to talking about how it all got started. So here's a funny story, right? So Chris was actually a fan of the Storybox before I reached out to him and asked him to be part of it and share his story. And then when we first met, he went for about 1 hour and 7 minutes. Then as I was going to release this episode, I could not find for the life of me his actual episode. So I stuffed up big time and I've gone to Chris and said, "Hey, Chris, I've lost your episode, mate." And he responds back. He's like, "Jay, if you want an excuse to hang out with me, all you got to do is ask." That just goes to show Chris's character. I mean, he's a very kind, generous person. And we got to talking the other day, actually, and ended up going for about 1 hour and 20-something minutes. So we extended the time, and before we actually hit record, we were talking for a good 30 to 40 minutes beforehand. Each and every time I see Chris, we're always talking for a while because, you know, that's what friends do, right? So like I said in the introduction, this episode is going to be thick and big, partly because of Chris's story, but also we are doing a thick and big giveaway. So this is what we're going to do. Two lucky people are going to walk away with their own bucket of thick cookies, okay? And all you need to do is three things. First thing, you got to make sure that you're following Thick Cookies and the Storybox podcast. All the links will be in the show notes below, as well as it'll be in the Instagram post or social media post as well. So you can't miss it. Secondly, here's a big one, okay? The people that actually do this have a higher chance of winning. Go to Apple Podcasts, type in the Storybox podcast. The links will all be available for you. If you have an iPhone, and if you don't have an iPhone, there's a way we can work around this as well. But if you have an iPhone, go to Apple Podcasts and leave a rating and review. Tag your review, post it on social media, tagging the Storybox podcast or Thick Cookies. Let us see it. And then you go into a even thicker entry of the potential of winning this bucket and merch, okay? Now, if you're an Android user, all you need to do is take a screenshot of the episode and post it to your stories and write a review there. Let everybody know what you think of the episode, because that's just as powerful. For those Apple users, you can do the same thing if you want. The choice is yours. The reason why I ask those Apple users to leave a rating and review is so that we can reach more people with amazing stories like this one. It's amazing how that actually works, but we'd really appreciate your support on this. And, you know, you get to enjoy cookies as well. So it's a win-win. The third thing you got to do, guys, is very simple. Is just enjoy the episode and pay it forward. So let all your friends and family know of this episode and get around and get amongst local businesses like Chris's and just share it around, show your support and show your love. Thank you so much to Chris for his time. second time running. And with that being said, everyone, let's dive into the story box and hear Chris Sheldrick's story.
Welcome. Nice to meet
you. It's an absolute pleasure to have you here. I should say, I won't say again, but delighted to have you once again. And I have one question that you know what's coming anyway that I love asking people to start off with, and that is, what does success look like to you?
Okay. I should start off, though, with the founder thing. I'm not sure if I brought this up because we know each other, but I should say it's not just me. It's me, my wife, her brother, and then his partner. So there's like a four of us who
the mix, everything.
Yeah, mix.
Of founders. So I was like your co-founder.
Yeah. I tend to be the face of things and do all the interviews and stuff like that. But it's all together we build all of it. But a definition of success, I said it before, because I already listened to the podcast, so I already know the question's coming. But hard to say. Definition of success. I wouldn't say it's money. I also wouldn't say it's, a lot of people will say maybe to work out some sort of work-life balance, but I don't really ascribe to work-life balance. We can easily be working 6-7 days a week, but then sometimes it doesn't feel, most of the time it doesn't feel like work because we're sort of doing what we built. Like we made these things, so working on it doesn't feel like work per se. So definition of success, I guess that's tied into probably happiness. But then you get onto like, what's the definition of happiness?
He knows me too well, guys. Yeah. Like it's not fair. Like I can't really ask him questions because he knows what's coming kind of. But I'm going to ask you not the definition of happiness, but what are the things that actually make you happy?
So we're doing Passion Tree Valley for 7 years and we got a whole bunch of stores. And then like Thick Cookies comes out of me wanting to, because I spend a lot of time in the office. After a certain point, just spend a lot of time in the office and don't really spend any time in shops. Whereas like the first shop, you're in there all the time, talking to people, etc. And it's like a year ago, I've been doing the Thick Cookies for like a year now, mostly on the weekends, just in my spare time, because I like going back to like markets and talking to people and having fun and working with friends and stuff like that. So that brings me happiness because people, you could say, want to move beyond that. Why am I working in the markets? But that's the fun that I enjoy having. That's why I enjoy waking up at like 4 o'clock in the morning every Saturday and getting ready for the markets and then seeing everybody line up and come for cookies and things like that. Whereas you could just be sitting back and letting everyone else do everything for you, maybe, but that also doesn't really apply for hospitality business anyway. You can't really just have a hospitality business run by itself.
So what gets you up in the morning at 4 a.m.? Is it every single morning or is it just market days?
It's just market days.
Yeah.
Yeah. Don't have to wake up really early anymore. Not like you. I know you wake up.
I'm the unlucky guy that gets to wake up at 4 a.m. in the morning to do interviews.
Well, but you wake up at 4 o'clock in the morning anyway to go to the gym, don't you?
Yeah, without doing interviews. So
yeah. Good morning, guy. I'm a stay up on my phone at night, even though I'm technically in bed at like 10. I don't go to sleep till 1 or something.
I'm the complete same. Opposite, dude. Like,
that's how basic I am.
6 a.m. is like my shut off time. So it's literally my brain.
6 p.m.
Oh, 6 p.m.
There
sorry.
You go. That shows.
See, it's showing now. Yeah. But that's what I mean. Like, my brain decides to shut off because I've been up so long.
Yeah.
Like, so early.
What gets me up at 4 o'clock in the morning, I like to just have everything organized on the market days rather than be rushed. So like I wake up, it's not rushing off at 4 o'clock in the morning. I wake up, just slowly have a coffee, get ready for the day, check everything's going all right, and then go set up and then just be set up and ready for people, all the customers to come. Cause we get some crazy fans, like crazy in like a good way. Like people come really early. And they'll like start making lines and things like that. But we'll be ready for them right away. That's pretty much it for in terms of why I want to get up early in the morning. But
you ever worry that there won't be those lines?
Yeah. Oh, but we have been pretty popular, the cookies, and you know, it's taken off in the past couple of months, and so we get approached to do bigger things. But I think it's the same thing people get approached for if they've got their first business. So like shopping centers come and all these different people come and go, oh, you should open a shop here, you should open a shop there, which I think can, it'd be easy to get carried away with thinking these people want you. But we're trying to control it and make sure we're not overexpanded. Everyone wants to wholesale the cookies. We're only supplying it to a few friends who we know have really good cafes, like Percy Plunkett's out in Penrith, and then we're doing it in our Banksy store in the city, things like that. So we're trying to control how, so it's not everywhere. It's not too commonplace.
Something that you can maintain.
Yeah, so we can quality control everything. We know where people are getting everything. We can track back a lot of that stuff. But to keep it somewhat exclusive and fun and interesting, like in terms of, I want to think of it, how would I want to, if I saw this food brand out there that I really like and willing to chase it down and follow it, then I would actually go and do that if that's the only way to get it.
Yeah.
But if it just has a street store, it's always one of those things where I'll go there eventually and then I'll never go. Yeah. It's like when, if something's like an exclusive food truck, I actually really make the effort to go and try those places and I'll try them over and over again. But if something's just a shop, I'm always like, I'll just go another time. So that's how I think and that's how I approach them. So we're trying to recreate. I would just do exactly the same thing. If this wasn't my business and I was just a customer, how would I go about it?
Mm.
Yeah, it's the same way we do our branding. People, because I see we have Passion Tree, which is a dessert bar, the original concept, Passion Tree Velvet, Thick Cookies, Big Brownies, Banksia Bakehouse. And people bring up, like, oh, how'd you brand them? How'd you come up with the idea? How'd you come up with the name? But we just design things and throw things around until it looks like something that we would like to eat at or shop at. It's like not really something you can do a lot of, you know, and there's no like scientific research you can do really behind some of that stuff. I mean, so maybe some of the, you can read some science about the way some colors and things like that. But if you've been to enough places, that's also just instinctively in your head. You can tell, oh, there's something slightly off about that one. There's something, something really attractive about this one, etc. But yeah, that's how we came up with almost all of those.
Seems almost very personal as well. Like you guys actually want to try it. So you test it out. And it happens to work because everyone else has got a similar idea.
Yeah, well, the cookie one in particular, so the actual story of the origins of Thick Cookies is as Passion Tree Velvet, we would do the tea festival every year and we would sell macarons.
Mm.
And then last year, we applied as Passion Tree Velvet to sell macarons, but they said they'd already signed up a few other macaron vendors. So they said, you know, which I totally respect because other markets wouldn't do this. Other festivals wouldn't do this. They would just sign up everybody and then have you all next to each other selling the same thing. But they said, sorry, we've got too many macaron vendors, so we can't accept you, or can you do something else? And the cookies has been something I've been wanting to do for a long, long time. But whether that was through the shops or creating something different. So we already had recipes developed. And we're like, oh, this is a perfect opportunity. So then we did the cookie concept at the tea festival last year, so 2019. And the way we came up with the concept and the branding, oh, so the concept and the branding is between, of Thick Cookies specifically, is by me and my sister. So my sister was doing it from England. And then she came over here on holiday and we just came up with the branding and stuff while she was on holiday over here. And it is black and yellow and the slogan is dangerously delicious. Thick cookies, dangerously delicious. And gotcha. All of the branding is based on the color scheme and items that we can get from Bunnings.
Bunnings.
Yeah. Because basically, So we didn't want to invest too much money on building a stall and branding and printing all this different custom stuff. So we do Dangerously Delicious Thick Cookies, and we just got all the emergency warning tape, the black and white warning tape, the road barriers, the blocked road signs, and all these different things that you can just pick up from Bunnings. And then we built our stall out of all of that stuff. And then Dangerously Delicious, warning, 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 Dangerously Delicious, Dangerously Thick as well is what we would say. And then we bought it all 2 days before the market. And then we did the market, and then we refunded it all the next day. Because it's all, apart from like the tape and stuff, but the road barriers and the road signs and all that kind of, like we, because it was just.
Like a one-off thing.
Yeah. So we just able to refund it because it wasn't used on the road or anything like that. And it was all untouched. It was just like a just in case. And then because it was so successful, we actually just end up buying it all again like 2 weeks later because we got approached to do things. More markets after that. But yeah, on the tea festival, I brought enough, like more stock than in terms of value than I would bring macaron stock. And I just thought, I just want to keep it full all day. So it just looks good. So we can take some nice pictures and then ask people and it might be quiet and just talk to people. What do you think about this stall? But like the moment we opened, we sold out like a 7 or 8 hour event and we were sold out in like 2 hours. Yeah, and people just lining up constantly. And we had no followers. We just set up the Instagram account like 2 days before that. And we just sold everything in like an hour and a half, 2 hours. And that was more dollar value than we would bring for Passion Tree Velvet Macarons. So people just went crazy. It was just hectic the whole time. And so that's how we sort of knew we were onto something.
How did that make you feel when you sold out in 2 hours?
Any festival. Because some of the festivals can be expensive. Like the Easter show is like $15,000. The Bastille Festival is $8,000 and things like that. So, and that with like, there's also opening a shop. It's like you can do all this work and then open. And then the fear is that just no one will come.
Yeah.
Which has happened at markets and shops.
So how do you manage your fear?
No, you just go into it expecting the worst. You just go to everything with fear. And then you don't even get to celebrate when you win. You just get to have relief that it didn't go badly.
Wow. But is that a bad thing though? Because that would put immense amount of pressure and stress on you if you're constantly fearing that it won't actually work.
What is it fearing? It's not fearing that it will work because it's not even fear. It's just... If it doesn't go as we wanted and you have that anxious, it's just anxious that, oh, I have to do even more work. You do a lot of work to get things open and get in a market or an event or a shop open. And then it's relief that it might be easy.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not like, I listen to your Percy Plunkett's podcast where his problem was Phil's problem was that he had too many customers from the first week. Yeah. No, that's
so but when you start your own brand, you don't know if this is actually going to be successful or not.
Yeah.
And I've always wondered, you know, what stress and anxiety and all that sort of stuff. So if you don't know going in, like you don't have that lead up or that build up, it's like walking into the unknown. And it's like any advice that you could give to someone that has an idea, that wants to do something with that idea, what advice would you give them?
I mean, a couple of ways. It depends how much you've committed yourself. But I mean, the cookies, as an example, we purposely did it so that it would be somewhat protected because we haven't massively overinvested. But then I wouldn't, because there's a line there, because part of it is don't invest too much and do some testing, but you have to be willing to spend money to do that original test.
So take risks?
I just mean in terms of the dollar, you do have to take some risks because it depends on your approach as well. Because for example, the thick cookies, we did spend like $300 or $400 or $500 printing like actual logos and banners and things like that. But in the grand, like that sounds like a lot of money just for like a 1 or 2 day event. But we were thinking long-term where $400 or $500 to test something now, but it still looked good. So people are not judging it based on that. They'll see the branding and things like that. Go, I can trust that. Then they buy the product, and then once they've been convinced to try the product, and then they like that, then that will be the real proof of the pudding.
Right.
Got to turn that into a pun.
Proof in the pudding. There you go.
We don't sell puddings though.
So. Oh, you might. You might. The pudding cookie.
Okay, we need to think about pudding brand.
Here we go, guys. We've got a little baby right here. Chris's brain's going a million miles an hour. I can just see.
But are people as familiar with puddings?
Sticky day pudding. That's hot. If you can crack the sticky day pudding market, you've got. You got to do.
Yeah, because the thick cookie one, people are really familiar with cookies, right? And same with creating big brownies. So people already have a point of familiarity with those products, and then all you have to do is just make them better than what they've had.
Yeah.
And those products as well, people will generally have a pretty basic – they would have had a pretty basic version of it most of the time. So because we're at our – Passion Tree Velvet is like we use all the top high-end – best ingredients, and we're trying to be like one of the best patisseries out there. So we already have all the best ingredients out here in here in the bakery. So we just transfer those over to make the cookies. But yeah, so I think because they've already got a point that they can relate to, they're willing to try it and then they can compare it amongst themselves. We have items in Passion Tree Velvet where if they had that, they would have nothing, they have no point of context. Like we have this we make like mousse items and things that we've had by going to patisseries in America and France and stuff, but most of the average person who walks past, they'll like it, but they won't know or realize if that's better than other items in that market, or so they don't really have anything to relate it to, whereas a cookie and a brownie they do. So it gives us the opportunity that if we know it's a really good product, people will have the confidence to tell other people that this is one of the best. Because people say also, we didn't really spend any money on marketing the product, but the cookie and it being the New York thick style cookie, it actually has like a moment to capture, to share, which is like the breaking apart of the cookie and having all the chocolate gooey and melty inside. Whereas most other food doesn't really have a moment to share. Like... Yeah, you don't really have like maybe a cheese toastie has that moment that you stretch the cheese out. You see that.
But, or pizza or.
Yeah, but.
Ice cream.
Just like, what would ice cream? What's the moment that's worth capturing?
I think it's the way it looks.
Yeah.
Like the different flavors. I mean, all
food has like, just the way it looks.
But they've got to have that actual specific moment where you.
And I think video does better. So a lot of people have just been sharing the video and then. All the time, like constantly, people are constantly saying, this is the best cookie I've ever had. Like, and we say like our mission is to create Australia's best cookie. And so many people constantly tagging us and writing in their stories, this is the best cookie I've ever had. And then all their friends and families or whatever watching those stories, they see best cookie they've ever had. That's a pretty big claim. I'll be the judge of that. So then they buy it. And then it was just this... viral
sensation,
like which you can't really I wouldn't because people ask us like how would you recreate that, but I don't know. I think we're just fortunate that the product is really good, and it actually, because it's so thick, people have a moment that they can share.
And so I can really attest to that, because
You get through loads of cookies.
I get too many.
I think you've had like 50 cookies in the past month. Right. Yeah, you had that.
And I still haven't gained an ounce.
Yeah, because you have to wake up at 6 o'clock in the morning
to burn it all off. So I keep coming back for more because I love it. But you know, Mum was saying to me the other day, she's like, Jay, you're eating so many cookies, you're probably going to get diabetes soon. I'm like, I'll be
mad. No, we're not good at it. High-end ingredients, New Zealand butter, Belgian chocolate.
Wow.
Makes it healthier, right?
So it actually is healthy-ish?
You just know that we would have really good ingredients as well. That's like the only real secret. People, you know, the cookies, they just have really good ingredients. That's it. We use really good vanilla. Because we're already using really high-end vanilla and butter and chocolate here anyway. So bringing in another cheaper chocolate and all that kind of stuff, it's just easier for us to stock control the really good stuff. And we're not going to use cheap stuff in our patisserie side anyway. And they say the best butters in the world are Irish French and New Zealand. And
I did not know that.
I think we use mostly New Zealand because it's closest anyway. But it's, New Zealand butter, I think, is one of the best. Yeah, so that's what we use here.
Wow.
And that's what's in all the cookies, yeah.
So that
that's
kind really of, the secret. How about the sugar?
Bundaberg sugar, yeah. But add sugar. That doesn't really make too much of a difference, yeah.
No, it's
brown
still,
or Demerara from Bundaberg.
But you don't like overload the cookies with sugar, do you?
It depends. Define overloaded. I would say the more unhealthy part of it is just the sheer amount of butter. Like most people wouldn't have had cookies with so much chocolate and butter. That's really the
It's mainly the fat content, which for those people that are listening, fat is not bad for you.
Yeah, it also depends that's true. The sugar is the one that you should maybe be careful of. But
yeah.
It depends like your definition. It's when people go, are these cookies really sweet? And even just within like our team, when people say some people think something's really sweet, some people think it's not sweet enough. Like, so it's a really hard question for us as, you know, dessert, patisserie, cookie, brownie people to answer for people, because you can say, oh, it's not that sweet to you, but it might be really sweet to them. So we always try to avoid that question.
Because everyone has, you know, different taste buds.
Yeah.
So what I think is too sweet might not be sweet.
Exactly.
To someone face else. That. Like, how do you keep up with that? Like, you just say.
Well, we tend to, for like the cookies, for example, we have a variety of different flavors and fillings. So if they say things like, I don't want something too sweet, we just point them in directions of other items.
Smart.
Yeah. Like, for example, the cookies and cream one is not too sweet, but that's literally just stuffed with Oreos.
Yeah.
So it's much more biscuity. Yeah. But then we have like a vanilla frosting one, which is really sweet.
I've had that one. And then you've got the strawberry one, which
is more like strawberries and cream.
Yeah. Which is absolutely.
Would you say that's sweet?
That's sweet.
Yeah.
So when
I would say that's more creamy. There you go.
I think it's sweet and creamy at the same time. Yeah. It's got a good combination. Like when I had it at the Penrith markets, I got back to the car and I'd finished the cookie. And I'm like, oh. Because I ate the whole thing. Plus I had a donut before that. And I was like, this is, yeah. It was a perfect combination though. I really, really liked it, man. So
yeah, I mean, and that's the thing, like, the cookies have just grown from the fact that it's such a good product.
Mm.
And that's not us going, this is the best cookie you guys got. It's just, yeah, people have just shared the fact that they've liked it so much. Yeah.
So what's the plan for the future?
Because
you are getting
world domination.
World domination. You're going to try and crack the new.
Because if you think of some other brands that you could really admire, they go pretty slow.
Like, yeah.
Slow and steady. Like, I don't know. I'm only thinking right now, like off the top of my head, some of the burger brands from America, like what was it, Five Guys, In-N-Out. They just go real slow, maintain the quality. I'm not really too concerned with like whether cookies is gonna, whether thick cookies might just be a flash trend, because cookies have been around forever.
Yeah,
you know, and I think the thing that does happen is people grow, they'll get onto a concept and then just dilute it and make as much fast money as they can, you know, whether that be like selling tons of franchises and growing up into every shopping center in the country, etc. But we'll just go slow and steady. Like whether or not, I think the next expansion would be to have the roaming market set up. So, you know, every weekend we go different markets around Sydney, but have that in Brisbane and then Melbourne. And then, you know, maybe we'll see how it goes, but maybe one day there might be a single shop in Sydney. We'll see how that goes. And if that goes and that works, then one shop in, then you can do world domination. One shop in Singapore, one shop in Hong Kong, one shop in London, one shop in New York. That'd be good. I haven't thought of that before. Maybe I should say that. The goal is to get one shop in New York. Oh, but the main goal is to get onto the Rock's cheat day.
Yes.
Yeah.
We're talking about that.
Yeah. That would be like just the the airy, dreamy goal. Like, just like a, it doesn't really, like, it doesn't need to convert to anything. It doesn't need to make us, because if The Rock did post and said, oh, I'm having these cookies, I'm enjoying them, the any followers or people who would be interested in follow us wouldn't really be local to here.
No.
They'd be, you might get a whole bunch more followers, but they wouldn't be real customers. So that wouldn't really be helpful. But it's just the fact that I'm already following him and like he's an inspiration, etc. That and he has those epic cheat days. So if he ever comes back here.
Let's play with that a little bit. So because he's got an epic cheat day, you wouldn't just give him a normal thick cookie, would you?
We got the 1 kilo ones, which are like the size of your head. So see how maybe get him some of those and see how many of those he can have.
Oh geez.
But he'd have to be probably in Sydney promoting some movie or filming something. So maybe someday
soon. I'm sure it'll happen. You never know, Chris.
Yeah, maybe a little while away.
Fingers crossed, you know. But I think I want to take you back a little bit to, I guess, how you grew up and some of the lessons that your parents taught you that have sort of helped you today in business. Did they help you in business at all? Like learn any of the tips and tricks?
I think our parents always wanted us just to let us do whatever we'd be interested in.
Yeah.
So one of my sisters is a teacher. One of my sisters works in film production. Oh. And then my other two brothers are photographers. So none of the sort of, be a lawyer or doctor type or an accountant type pressures. But, and in terms of, my mum's always been starting her own businesses, etc. Whether that be, I think she had a cafe briefly, but language school, tutoring school, things like that. But whether or not they inspired me to be a business, it's more just the freedom. Like they would have been pretty weird because when I was 12 or 13, it was early days of eBay.
Mm.
So not early days, it was like 4 years after eBay started. But 12, 13, I was actually importing stuff to, I don't know if I've mentioned this before, but I used to be, when I was like 13 or something, 13, 14, something like that, I was an eBay power seller.
No way.
Yeah. So my parents had to put up with, I would order stuff from China or like wholesale suppliers and things like that. And all these people who weren't on eBay. And I buy things by the pallet and just show up at our house, which is always a thing because, I mean, now I know because we have a warehouse, but a truck would show up with a pallet of stuff and we don't have a forklift to take it off the truck. So the guy would have to wait there with his truck. Well, he's normally just used to driving up, someone pick it off the back of the truck, drop it down and he goes, whereas we'd have to like unload it by hand into our driveway. So we're doing that when I was 13, 14. And to be a power seller back then, you had to sell 3,000. So I'm from England originally. So it'd be £3,000 a month for like 6 months consistently. And then you get a power seller badge. And yeah, so I was 13, 14 when I was doing that. And I spent all my time browsing the internet and finding little items that and watching the trends on eBay and things. And then that was really early on with, I think it was Alibaba or one, I can't remember if it was that exact site or not. And then, you know, send off all the interest forms and buy boxes of stuff from China. So I did that for like 2 or 3 years on eBay, just packing things. So I always found that pretty just fun. It's like a game, like hit these, make the money, hit the targets. These things come in, these things come out. And then I think really where that eBay stuff really took off was when there's like this transition period. Like I think in the late 90s, early 2000s, a lot of independent video game and computer stores existed.
Yep.
And then, you know, those started to get crowded out and outcompeted by big chains who use their purchasing power to buy games and computer parts and bits on a bigger scale. So I was doing eBay at a time when a lot of independent small game shops, console shops, computer shops were closing down. And then, oh yeah, I think I was 15 or 16. 15? 16? And I just got onto liquidation auctions. And the what I knew was games and video games and things. So I would just be, I'd be picking up these really cheap liquidated video game pallets. And then I'd receive them all, break them all down, list everything out on eBay, and then sell that. So yeah, I got pretty fortunate, got some really good deals, and then would sell it all because it was liquidated shops. So all the stock was new.
Hmm.
Or almost all new. It depends if it was like a secondhand game shop. So then I would just list it all on eBay as just new stock that I got for really, really cheap. Although I don't know now whether or not I was actually even earning minimum wage for the amount of hours I was working. Like, I didn't know. I don't know. I can't remember how much. Just worked so much. So I don't know if that would be a viable business right now. But I was just having, I just had fun doing it. So,
so you knew very early on that you wanted to be in business for yourself.
Yeah, and the original question was about the parents. So, yeah, they always tell a story of when I was really young. Because in England, we had this, I don't know if you heard it, we had this game called Conkers.
Yes.
Do you know Conkers? Yes. Yeah, Conkers is like a sort of chestnut.
Yep.
And then you tie a string to it. No, you have to drill a hole through it and put a string through it. And then you smash each other's Conkers. And we had a tree in a park near us. And I would go and collect them all, drill the holes and put the string, because that's the thing people couldn't do, is drill the hole and put the string through. And then I would pick all those up, set them up with the strings, and then go take them to school and sell them. So I used to do that when I was a kid, like much younger. I think that was probably like 6, 7, 8. Yeah. I wasn't using the drill, but my parents helping. So like they told that at my wedding, for example, like,
So you're doing business at 7, 8 years old, and then you moved into eBay, and it was setting you up for later in life, which is...
Yeah. Well, so I used to go to a really good school in England.
Mm.
That I'd take a test to get into. And then I spent all my time doing eBay instead of doing schoolwork per se. But it's funny because we had a business studies... I did study business studies, but then we had a teacher, Mr. Denton, and then he would have us get up. He would have me get up at certain times and give updates on my business.
So no one else in the class was doing business but you?
No, not really. Not like, but yeah, I mean, that's a, no, yeah, I don't think anyone else really was.
So you had personal experience.
There was one other kid in the school in my year, Monil, who was selling server space. So he was renting and selling server space. But anyway,
wow. Yeah,
that was more impressive than what I was doing, but that was complicated. But yeah, and so my point is that, so, and then we have these things called GCSEs, and I didn't do so well on the GCSEs. So then you had to have a certain amount of A's. I think you needed like 8 A's out of 11. I think I got like 4. Or 5, and then all the rest B's. It turned out that all you had to do was just ask them to let you in. But
they wanted to see you stress.
A lot of other people got much worse grades.
Yeah.
And still got let back in. But I just took that as, all right, have to move school. So then I moved to another school. And then, I don't know, there was no pressure from my parents, but just thought I'd concentrate on studying. So all that eBay stuff. I had a few things which were really lucrative that I just kept on the background, but I didn't spend any time on it. And so for my last few years of school, when we get into A-levels, I concentrated more on studying. And then I moved to school in Wimbledon, you know, for the tennis.
Yeah.
And yeah, so stopped doing some of that eBay stuff then. And then... gone into a university, went to King's College in London, which is a good uni. And I studied geography there. I was the president of the Geography Society. Yeah. Always can't just sit back and think, I've got to like do something.
Yeah.
But I would say like and then after university, throughout university, I was studying geography, but all I would do is like read up all the startup news and all the tech startups. I was just constantly following that. And then like following them and then applying for internships and all that kind of stuff. And I actually I found out about this company called Groupon really early on, like a day or two after they launched, they just had this viral success. And then I'm constantly messaging them saying, oh, I'm in England. You guys are going to set up an office in England soon for sure. Can I be an intern? All that kind of stuff. And then like after a couple of months after they, I think like 6 or 7 months after they were really big, like as in after they launched and everyone was talking about Groupon all the time, really, really big, they actually did offer me to come to, I think, to America. Was it America or Canada? I come wherever their head office was and then do a couple of months in the office there and then go back to London to be part of the London opening team. Wow. But it would have meant that I'd have to drop out of uni. I seriously considered it. But
so what stopped you?
It was a big move.
Were you afraid?
Was I afraid? I think at the time it just felt, and I would understand that now, how frantic and crazy early startups were.
Mm.
But it didn't really feel really official. Like it was just someone emailing me back saying, oh yeah, you come work over here and we'll do this. So making a big move without really strict, without like any real structure to it, especially being a kid, like moving to America, like how would things like visas and all that kind of stuff work? And they couldn't really give answers to that. So they did, I think it wasn't.
So none of the signs were there really.
No, was it? It just wasn't a put together offer that you just like really formally accept.
Mm. No contracts.
No. You know, an interesting thing, I jumped a little bit there, but so I was either going to go to uni. Mm. I was either going what was it? No, when I didn't do well in the GCSEs, which was like 16, 17, I could either go to another school, Wimbledon, and then keep studying and then go to uni, or I was going to go to EA Games and be a game tester, right?
Ah.
But, and it's that
my younger brother's dream job.
Yeah. Well, at the time, I was like 16, 17, and I was like, game tester, that's the dream job. And then my interview was on the same day that the terrorist bombings happened. And so I couldn't get to the interview. And then they called us all up and said, I'm going to reschedule. So it was 7-7, 2007. Was that 2007? I can't remember, but the 7-7 bombings in London. So and they called us all up and said, we're going to have to reschedule the interviews. And then they never rescheduled them. So then I went to school, yeah. So I could have gone down working in a games company. But that was a little bit of a
I like that because it's interesting how you've had all these things leading up to like starting your own business quite young and you decided to go a different route, which is study. Why not just start your own business?
Oh, yeah. So that's what I was going to get at is, I followed all this news and tech startup news and all the stuff and be a startup founder, all the kind of thing. And I just found myself spending all my time reading and learning about all that stuff, especially in my last year of uni. So, where it's almost like, did I study the wrong thing or should I have gone to uni? And even thinking, looking back, I probably should have just, if I just stuck even with the eBay stuff, it probably would have been better than uni. Uni was fun, you know, partying and drinking, all that kind of stuff. But that was like more of a thing where I felt like I had to go away and check some boxes that everyone's supposed to do.
Yeah.
Like if you're going to ask me now, I wouldn't have gone to uni. I would have just kept doing business. But obviously now everyone talks about, you know, this sort of hustle life and everyone has to be an entrepreneur and business person. But when you're like, what was it 2000? I can't remember that, my dates on my head, but yeah, like 12, 14, 15 years ago. Yeah, well, how old am I now? Well, about 15 years ago, people would were actively discouraging, don't do that kind of thing.
Now it's so, almost glorified.
Yeah, and it wasn't from my parents. My parents weren't saying don't do it.
Yeah.
They wouldn't. They were happy to support either way. But yeah, now it's like really glorified. So everyone
wants to be an entrepreneur. Yeah. Now. Yeah.
But
the name, everyone's like, yeah, it's almost like you're a celebrity.
Because even the year out after uni, I just spent working at startups. So I'd work at startups for free during the day, and then work. I had a job as a front of house event manager around London at different events at night. So I just worked night to make my money, and then work during the day at internships. I did like 4 or 5 internships throughout the year, like 2 or 3 months each at different tech startups and variety of different types of businesses, where, and I specifically wanted to go to those businesses and do a bit of everything in each one of those. And it'll be like small teams, like 5, 10, 15, 20 people in each startup, and then go around and do everything. So that was good. That was a lot of fun. I definitely realized after that's definitely like my privilege, in the fact that, because I didn't have to pay rent because I lived at home.
Yeah.
So I had a family home to live at, and I was able to make money by working at night. But being able to work for free at a internship, most people don't have that opportunity. Yeah. Not just opportunity as in someone offers you the opportunity, but the ability to work for free and not have to like pay for food and stuff. So I look back and that's definitely the real fortunate thing that I had. Because your question was like, what happened to the parents? That's what parents provided for sure, that you don't think about necessarily at the time.
Mm.
You think that, I'm doing an internship working for free. I'm so special. Like, look at me, I'm giving up my time to learn stuff. But other people have to earn money to feed themselves and pay rent, so sort of thing. So that's definitely like my middle class privilege there. So I did that, and then I spent a year teaching English teaching in Korea, but not English. I'm not very good at teaching English. I taught geography and history to kids who were preparing for international school in America or in England. So I did that, and because I had a good university, I got paid really well, and I definitely treated that year as more of a fun year, because you get paid like $50 an hour to do that. So I was like, oh, I only need to work 2 hours a day, 3 hours a day. Whereas really, looking back, I should have worked 8 hours a day and then put a bunch of money away. But no, I would just work two or three hours a day, and then just party and have fun. So I did that for a year, and then travel around Asia from Korea as a center point. And then I came back to England, and then in the UK, they've got this program called the New Entrepreneurs Foundation, where every year they pick 25 to 30 of the future potential entrepreneurs of the country. And that I applied for that. And you have to go through this whole long interview process, and they bring everyone together and they do sort of character building or like sort of group tests and all this kind of stuff. And they analyze and take notes and things, and they choose 25 people out of a few hundred. And so I did that for a year. So that's actually a program where you get paid to be on it. So you get paid like the equivalent of 50,000-60,000 Aussie dollars. So it's not like, so it's half decent amount of money. And you spend a year shadowing a CEO. No, you spend a year working with a entrepreneur who is running a company and still running that company. So I did, I worked, because of the background of me working at tech startups, I worked at a company called Gamesys. So it's an online gaming company in Piccadilly Circus. So I spent a year doing that. And then one day a week, so we also paid to be one day a week going to study the entrepreneurship master class at like UCL, and going having speeches and talks and classes from all the consultant groups, KPMG, Accenture, Deloitte, all those different people. So one day a week, and we all paid to do that. And I think it's somewhat pretty prestigious. There's a lot of other good people. We started off, the year started off at Richard Branson's house. So we had, we started off at Richard Branson's house. That's why I've got a picture of Richard Branson on my LinkedIn. And it ends the year at, in Westminster, every other year, apart got to finish it with the Prime Minister, apart from our year. So wow. we only got to do it at the Houses of Parliament. Yeah. But all the other years, everyone's with the Prime Minister, where they go, you know. So we start the year at Richard Branson's house, and we finish the year in Parliament, per se. So it's got some prestige, to it. And but that was really good because that's a network of other young entrepreneurs, and it tends to be people who they see as being the future potential entrepreneurs of the country. And then in the last few months of that year, I was helping. I was doing all the online and design work for Passion Tree. So I originally got involved with Passion Tree because it wasn't called Passion. I came up with the name Passion Tree as well, but it's my wife's family's business. It was this one store on Elizabeth Street in Brisbane. They hadn't come up with a name yet, but they had like this quote for a designer. And because I know how to use all the design softwares, like the Illustrator, InDesign, and they're getting quoted, a couple of $1,000 for this and a couple of $1,000 to build a website, et cetera. And I was like, I can just do all that for free. I'll just do all that for free. And then because I know that the design process can be, if you don't know what you want, it can get really expensive, like sending off revisions constantly, whereas I would just do it all for free. And then that's how we came up with Passion Tree, the original one. The original Passion Tree it started off the concept as meaning to be a patisserie, but it being the first store to have a thing, I call it like feature creep, which is what they say in the tech world, where you just keep adding things. Oh, this is a good idea. Let's add this. That's a good idea. Let's add that. So at that time, it's 2013, and what was really popular then? Max Brenner was really popular then. Centuros was blowing up. Noggi and Mucci, the Froyo companies, they were blowing up. Breadtop was blowing up. So the very first Passion Tree had all a Froyo section. It had all the Breadtop items. It had like all this chocolate stuff, like Max Brenner. And then it had the patisserie. So that one was just called Passion Tree. And it was meant to be a patisserie cafe. And it just became this general dessert bar. But it did become really popular. Like we were number one or number two on, it used to be called like the Urban Spoon. Mm. And Urban Spoon, every city would have the top 10 places, regardless of cafe, restaurant, or the most trending places. And we were like in the top 10 for a whole year. So it was really, really popular. But it wasn't the patisserie was popular, but it was more the rest, like the vibe of the store, the rest of the menu, all the desserts, and it was built for sharing. So all the desserts were sharing items. And I was in England. And then, like I said, it's my wife's family's business. And because I probably saved them like $10,000 in design work. They, as a thank you, they flew me out to Australia to see like all the signage and all the menus that I made and all of that stuff, to see it in person as like a thank you, like a couple of, that's like what, $2,000 to fly someone out, and I saved them $10,000 or such. But when I flew out, it was the really bad floods in Brisbane. So they were supposed to open a few weeks before I got there, but because of the floods,
couldn't open.
They couldn't get any electricians or people to certify for it to open. So I went out there just to see a building site. Like pretty much finished, but they just couldn't get all the electrical certifications and all that kind of stuff to open. So then I went back. I just had a holiday here, basically. Then I went back, and then they flew me out a few months later again, and I was still doing all the website, running all the social media, all the kind of stuff from England. So I just do it at night. And then on the second trip over, we talked about like, why did we do Passion Tree? Why did they do Passion Tree? And it was meant to be for the patisserie, because that was what they pictured and what we all pictured as like the gap in the market. So then on that second trip, we put together the concept for Passion Tree Velvet. And the Velvet is just supposed to be the more premium part of it. And then on that trip, I also shopped around to find, like, that's just, yeah, it was just the approach. Like, I was getting an idea. Okay, let's just, well, how do we approach this? Just start calling people. People always like afraid to call. So I just call up like shopping centers and like, I want to open a shop. How does that happen? Mm. You know, just, and then you can just call and say, how do I do this? And then people will put you in touch with other people. I'm always just not afraid to like just make a phone call and ask questions. And
there's a lesson
yeah,
there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Big one. If you don't ask, you don't get.
Yeah. And then so we opened our first shop in Carindale West. So yeah, we put together this concept, Passion Tree Velvet. Is targeted towards like the shopping center shopper, only trades during the daytime, whereas Passion Tree was becoming more of a dessert bar and that traded at night. And Passion Tree Velvet was, yeah, more the patisserie. And that, once we created that first one in Carindale, that was the one that really started to take off. So the second time I came to Australia, we came up with the concept of Passion Tree Velvet. And then my wife's dad offered, okay, let's execute on this. He'll sponsor my visa to come and actually execute on the Passion Tree Velvet concept. And yeah, so I went back to England because you have to go back to apply for visa to a working visa to come back, and then came back, and then we opened 8 Passion Tree Velvets in 2 years, seven or eight, yeah, and moved interstate. So I was in Gold Coast. We did Carindale, Robina, Indooroopilly, and Coolangatta. And then we moved to Sydney, and then we did Macquarie, Balgala, Broadway. Then we added Pacific Fair back in the Gold Coast. So we grew really quick and did interstate. Then the business was just okay. And we were cruising for a bit. Because it's supposed to be an economic crash it goes in cycles, right? Every 6 to 10 years. So at that point, when we had finished building like 8, 9 stores, we were thinking there's going to be a crash soon. So if we sign any more of these 5, 7, 8 year leases, the crash is going to come 3 or 4 years into a lease, and then we're going to be overexposed with all these leases. So let's just sit and wait a year or two, build up our cash reserves, just keep fixing the business, because we grew too fast. So we grew really fast. I'm not sure about too fast. We grew really fast, and then we spent time fixing all our systems and operations, etc., which took longer than probably we were expecting. But it's good because things work so smoothly now. And then that crash never really came. Like, it's come now, obviously, because of the coronavirus, but, you know, we were expecting there to be some sort of little crash eventually, and then we can pick up some, sign some leases after that, once there's been the correction, etc. Because also there's just a thing where, because the cakes and the bakery and patisserie fills sites that you're also competing in terms of sites. You're competing with people who are trying to open cafes or coffee shops, and everyone's opening a cafe or coffee shop like over the past 3 or 4 years. So it's hard to open in a very crowded space. Although we are different to everybody else, because we're not just selling cups of coffee. We're selling like boxes of macarons and like $50, $100 birthday cakes for parties. But just competing for the spaces from an opening shops perspective. And that sort of brings us to that period of time where we sort of like a year and a half since we'd opened a shop, and then start looking for more to do, and coming up with the cookies a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that brings us full circle. So yeah, then that's back to the story of then doing cookies. And then really the cookies, I was doing cookies pretty slowly in terms of customer traction. We did a couple of events, and those were just like, you know, grafting. The first event was super popular, crazy. Like we sold tons and tons, and it really hit it off. But then a few events after that, you know, we had a bunch of wastage, and we'd have to really like talk to customers and explain what the cookie is, et cetera, like that, and give people tasters and ask people to try and, you know, grab people, call people over, hey, come try these. Have you seen these cookies? And all that kind of stuff. But then when the, we're doing that every week, doing different markets, different events, nothing really to write home about. And then I think in February we had like, yeah, 500 followers, etc. But then when we had the shutdown and all of our shops had to close, I pushed all the cookies online and offered all on home delivery. So we turned all these office workers, all the office workers here became delivery drivers around Sydney. And then we offered shipping around Australia, and it just took off. So I think around March 23rd, we had 500 followers. And then like as of yesterday, we have like 14,000. And we, tomorrow morning, we'll hit our 4,000th online order.
4,000.
4,000 orders, yeah. So the thick cook, so what it's meant that is that Passion Tree Velvet, because it's a hot, it is still food and hospitality, it's we didn't have to fire anybody.
Mm.
We were able to keep everybody employed, and getting people to do different things, like become a delivery driver or make cookies, etc. But yeah, so we were able to keep all the staff employed, and now things have started to reopen. And so the cookie sales have dropped now as people are able to go out and shop, but then the online orders have dropped, but then they've just been coming to the markets.
So markets as well. Pick up and...
Yeah, it was this thing we never had before was lines of people.
Yeah.
Whereas now we have to have like markers and things that say social distance, because, and then farmers markets have to put us in special places where they can let a line build up.
Mm.
Well, allowing people to be socially distanced, but yeah. So it's kind of like an overnight success, but it took years and years to become an overnight success.
which is another lesson in of itself, yeah. You know, all the hard work that you guys have put in to do, not just Nick Cookies, but Passion Tree Velvet, now Banksia as well.
Yes.
So Big Banksia, Brownies.
Yeah, Banksia Bakehouse was, we're doing Passion Tree Velvet, and then, so Passion Tree Velvet's our patisserie cake shops, which are served from a central bakery, and we deliver out every day to all the stores. But it means that we can have a central bakery with all of our skilled staff, and then all the shops, it's just small shops that don't require a whole big team of bakers in every location and all the equipment. But we wanted to create sort of a flagship where people can see that everything is handmade and made by skilled staff and all the kind of thing. Because it is. And so we thought about making a flagship, but then we decided to not have it be called like Passion Tree Velvet's flagship. We decided to create a whole new concept, which just can be its own attraction in the city of Sydney. And it's again, it's something that we saw as a gap. Like in Melbourne, they have a lot of good cake shops and patisseries on every other street corner. Whereas in Sydney, there's not really anywhere to, in the business district with all the offices, there's not really anywhere to go get birthday cakes or go and watch or get fresh made pies like that are baked there, or you know, croissants that are rolled right in front of you and baked in the morning. So that doesn't exist in the CBD, like the real central CBD. I think there's La Renaissance in the Rocks. There's like Rollers in Manly.
Yeah.
They have good croissants, but then that's it. Whereas in Melbourne, you'd find them on every other street corner. So that's what we spotted in terms of a gap in the market. And then we also wanted to be with patisseries. People always brand them as French.
Yep.
No matter where you go in the world, if like you're in Argentina and you go to a patisserie, they'll say something along the lines of their French style patisserie, whether you were a soup, the really like fancy concept, you would say they're French patisserie. If you had the, just your local little person trying to do their little cake shop, they'll say they're a French patisserie. But in Australia, with like the type of ingredients we're using, like a lot of mostly Australian ingredients and Australian staff and the Australian, like Australian standards of food, like people, the customers expect such a high standard. Mm. We should just be an Australian patisserie. Yeah, don't bother with saying, oh, look at us, we're trying to be French. No, like saying you're an Australian patisserie means more, means as much or more when people come in. So then that's kind of the inspiration between behind it, calling it Banksia, like name it after an Australian native flower. And I, since moving to Australia, I love all the Australian native flora. Like at my wedding, we everyone had the, like my wife as well, like all the flowers and everything were all Australian native plants. Like no like colorful, big, no like roses and all that kind of stuff. It was all Australian natives, all very Australian, Australiana themed. So we love all the natural botanics in Australia. So that's what the idea between for the name of Banksia Bakehouse. And then we were thinking, you know, Banksia Bakehouse, people are more likely to, well, again, what would I expect coming to Sydney? Or do I come to Sydney and then go to the French cake shop? Or do I go to Sydney and go to the Australian cake shop? Yeah, so we, and then we'll, and then in Banksia we'll be selling croissants, et cetera, and things like that, but then also all the meat pies and handmade meat pies, which we can't seem to find any good meat pies in this city.
Nope.
But there is now, Banksia Bakehouse.
Well, there's, yeah, there's Banksia. I haven't even tried them yet, but there's like the one good pie that I did have was Harry's.
Oh, yeah.
Kafta Wheels. Yeah. But like they're a bit different. Like they put mash
that's
stuff
pretty
on
traditional.
Top.
They're good. Yeah. I would say they're, yeah, it's a tough thing when I say Sydney CBD.
Yeah.
Like, in my head, that's like around the Rocks to like Town Hall.
Yeah, I don't think station, Harry's in.
Harry's is more near Central Station.
Yeah.
I would say the big difference there is people actually live near Central Station. People actually live around there, whereas in closer up to the CBD, it's more hotels and office workers.
Yeah.
That's why I keep saying, oh, they don't have this in the city. They actually do. They have it in Surry Hills Central Station because people actually live around there.
Mm.
So they've got more of a stable shopper. The city worker is a stable shopper as well.
But if they want quality pastry, quality pies, go to Banksia.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We're doing it, and we got a supportive landlord up there at Grosvenor Place, 225 George Street. And I think other people aren't offering it because, and they go out to Surry Hills or, you know, Alexandria or Central Station sort of area, Redfern area, because they're priced out of being in the CBD. Priced out from, they are expensive rents, but then also you really only trade 5 days a week because there's no office workers on the weekend.
Mm.
But we wanted to take that risk to create a destination down there. So we're sort of close-ish to the Rock, so we can pull people away from the tourist destinations of the Rock and still capture a lot of the business workers. And we want to be established as a place you can come to Banksia Bakehouse, speak to a staff and get a custom birthday cake made and decorated. You can see it being decorated behind there. And that service doesn't exist there. But there's plenty of people in the city having birthdays, you know, celebrating, oh, I've just passed my probation, we've just launched version 2 of this, you know, I'm going on maternity leave, I've just returned from maternity leave, I'm retiring, I've been working here, not only this is my birthday, but this is my work birthday, like I've been working here for 5 years, I've been working for 2 years, and tons of reasons to have cake.
Yeah.
But there's no real cake shops in the city. It's weird. Yeah.
It sounds like you've cracked the market, man.
Yeah. But it's very much a thing of where, why is no one else doing this?
Like yeah.
Cake shop. But us, because we're not doing it.
Yeah.
We literally have all the ability to do it and we're not doing it. You can't really say that question of why is no one else doing it. That's the same, actually, the original origins of the thick cookie. Because the thick cookie is, say, you say it's New York style cookie, and it's based on these two companies, Levain Bakery in New York and Chip Bakery. Levain is the original one, but they're, and I had them in New York like 12 years ago. I've always been like, oh, this is the best cookie. Why is no one else doing it? Why is no one else doing it? Like just waiting around for someone else to do it. And yeah, same thing.
Waiting for you to do it, man.
Like no one's doing it because I'm not doing it. I literally work at a bakery. We have the facilities and the ingredients and everything just to do it. And I'm not doing it. So I did it.
Yeah. I think that's the problem. Like everyone is afraid to actually start and they think that someone else is going to do it.
Yeah.
And they worry too much about whether or not someone is actually going to do it rather than just starting and then yeah. worrying about the aftermath.
But I would say like I was already in a position to be able to execute on it.
Yeah.
Like even like this podcast, I've always wanted a podcast that interviewed like local business people.
Mm.
But then I don't have any, I have no idea what I'm doing with this recording stuff. Whereas you already have had a background in,
well, know, video, I wanted the same thing.
Yeah.
Like every time I went out to places, which was rarely ever, I was always curious about, well, what's yeah. this person's story?
You everything know? From like all the hotels, the restaurants and cafes, etc. I want to know this person who has a big plumbing business. How did they grow and things like that? So that's, I very much feel the same way about your podcast. It's like, just, I'm like, oh, why is no one doing interviewing local business owners? Mm. It wasn't my place because I have no air, I have no experience in that. But that same sort of approach with the cookies where, you know, I was thinking, waiting for someone else to do it because I love the product. And I'm like, that's enough reason to want to do it myself because I know I would love it. Yeah, and I love the cookies.
Mm, I love them
like
too.
I eat them all the time as well.
Yeah, us.
We're always eating them at home. Like, and you know, you can go, because we have 13 flavors and we're always trying new flavors out. So you can go like a week or two of not trying one of the flavors.
Yeah.
And then you have a flavor and it's like, damn, I remember why we looked. This is so good.
My favorite one to date has to be their caramel choc chip.
Yeah?
Yeah. I love it. I don't know what it is, but
it's really good chocolate.
It's really so expensive. Good.
So we have a problem with that one where the chocolate's really expensive and it comes from Belgium. So sometimes it runs out. And especially with the coronavirus stuff where they've had problems with the managing the stock. So like bringing it in. So that's been out of stock here and there because it's, and they're super popular as well. Yeah.
So it's the caramel one. And the strawberries and cream one.
Yeah. Yeah. Strawberries and cream is one of my favorites.
Those two are gold. Everything else doesn't really compare. I mean, they're great. But for me, those two are the best.
My favorite one right now is the apple pie.
Yeah, oh, apple yeah.
pie. Yeah. We put all the apple pie spices in the dough. And then we make the apple pie.
Oh, you do?
Yeah. So all the spices you would expect in apple pie, we blend them through the dough. And then the apple pie filling, we make all that, cut up the apples and make all the apple pie filling from scratch here. And then we, you know, that's stewed down for like hours.
I don't think I've tried that one.
Oh, you should have it. That's my favorite because it's not a straight choc chip cookie, whereas all the other ones are sort of variations of choc chip cookies. So for me, I've eaten so many of the cookies where I'm like, I like the more interesting flavors. We do more of the interesting flavors, a lot for ourselves. Like so it keeps us, keep wanting to eat them.
You know what I like as well? A nice hot cinnamon cookie.
Okay. Keep your eyes.
Yeah.
Keep your eyes peeled for the next few weeks.
Like, tell you what, some of my fondest memories is when my mum would make homemade cookies, but she wouldn't overload them with sugar. It'd be cinnamon.
Okay.
And
what would you call that cookie?
Cinnamon style cookie. Okay. Like it was nothing special, but it just hit the spot. Like you warm them up and you want to eat more.
Because in America, they'd call that, I think they would call it a snickerdoodle.
Yeah.
But I think people don't really know what a snickerdoodle is. They think it's
Snickers. Aussie's like, yeah, snicker.
Yeah.
But
we're doing a cinnamon scroll.
Yes.
So, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. I'll show you after the photos. We were testing them on Friday. Yeah, and then we got a lemon meringue cookie, which will only be available in certain places because we have to pipe meringue on top of it. And then we've got a macaron cookie coming out. But
damn. Yeah.
But
and special
you'll
edition.
You'll be one of the first people to try.
Yes.
I'll send you over just, to try some taste.
Just call me up and say, Jay, we're taste testing. Come over. And I'll be like, I'm there.
Come. But the thing about inviting people over taste testings for any of the companies, like Passion Tree, Thick, Big, everything, is that people will just come and then go, yeah, it's all good.
No.
Because we'll generally have like 5 or 6 different versions of every little thing we try.
Yep.
And then it's sort of, we have to pick which one's the best and which one works operationally and which one works from shelf life perspective and things like that. But if visitors come in,
I'll give you a full rundown, man.
That one, they're all good.
Yeah.
Just sell all of them. Because they are all good.
I'll give you a full list of this is what I think. And
you
I
have
do
to be
that.
More specific on exactly why is this one better than that one.
I will be.
Yeah.
Yeah. 100%. My taste buds, man, they are something else.
Like, okay.
I'm brutally honest.
I will put that to the test.
When it comes to something, like if I don't like something, like I don't know if you've seen any of my reviews. Like yesterday, I tried M&M's. Pretzel.
Oh yeah,
did not taste like pretzel at all.
Yeah, but you still like them. They're still good, right?
I still enjoyed the fact that because they're M&Ms, right? Yeah. Like they still taste nice, but there was no pretzel in them.
I like those ones. It's more they're trying to go for that salty chocolate.
Yeah, but it wasn't combo. It wasn't that for me. Like it didn't hit that. You're advertising that it's pretzel, and yet you're not getting that pretzel taste.
Yeah.
To it, it just didn't work. It was more. I think the milk chocolate overtook the pretzel.
Yeah, that's right.
And
that's always something, that's the kind of thing we always have to think about.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if you've tried the Jelly Top chocolate.
No, I haven't.
Whittaker's, that is something else.
Is it?
Yeah, it is. Because
I do like Whittaker's chocolate.
Oh, yeah, this chocolate.
Jelly Top,
it's white chocolate and you got jelly in the middle. You try it. And then the flavors also on the bottom, you got milk chocolate, just normal milk chocolate. So you got 3 different flavors all melting in your mouth.
Because like also you have to remember, I'm not Australian.
Yeah.
So there's a lot, like I still haven't gotten around to trying Milo.
What?
Wait, so an early flavor of cookie was chocolate orange. Because in England, chocolate orange is really popular. We've got Terry's chocolate orange. But people thought that was strange here. In England, we have Jaffas, which are chocolate orange, Jaffa cakes, and Terry's chocolate orange. And everyone is used to having chocolate orange. But here, we're going to be at markets, and the few people who would buy it, because I really liked it, that's why we had it. The few people who would buy it, I would ask them, you wouldn't happen to be English, would you? And like, 80% of them are English. But we discontinued it because it is only English people buying it.
See, that's the thing, Like, I never really got into Jaffas.
No, yeah.
I was never liked them.
But there's other flavors like the Jelly Top.
And Jelly Top.
Candies here. That
Like
a Cherry Ripe. But I mean, obviously I've had Cherry Ripes. But I mean,
I'm not a fan of Cherry Ripe.
I like Cherry Ripe. But that's like one that's an Australian, I think it's Australian flavor, yeah.
Mm.
So they're more common. They're more used to that.
I think as well, I tried the Marvelous Creations one. And my favorite one was the Jelly Beans inside of it. The popping candy didn't work.
No.
All the other ones didn't work. And then they came out with this new one where I think it was marshmallows inside or something. It was like the birthday cake edition. Did not taste good.
What do you expect a birthday cake to taste like?
Like, to be honest with you. Yeah, to be honest with you, a birthday cake needs to either be vanilla, chocolate, you've got your standard flavors, right, for a good birthday cake. The ones that I had growing up.
No, I mean as in birthday cake flavor. What does that
mean? It needs to be creamy, mate.
Yeah?
Like it needs to have that cream.
The definition is what you just said. It generally is just vanilla.
Yeah.
So our frosting flavored cookie, vanilla frosting flavored white chocolate cookie, we used to call birthday cake.
Yeah.
But then people would just think that's only for birthdays. So we changed the name.
No, you can have birthday cake whenever you want, but you got to make it good.
You're saying about birthday cakes, a secret. We, for Banksia and Passion Fruit Velvet, like we can do a whole bunch of different interesting flavors, but the bigger the cake and the more people you have to cater for at an event, the more standardized your flavor should be.
Mm.
Yeah, so if you've got like 50 people and you want a birthday cake, like my birthday cake was a peanut butter cake.
Yeah.
It's because I love peanut butter. And we launched that after doing it at my birthday because it was so good. But people wouldn't buy it because you don't know if if you're going to vent for 20 people, are all 20 of them going to like peanut butter?
No,
you can be sure that half
allergies as well, and
you can be sure that no one will make any complaints if you just had vanilla.
Yeah.
Yeah, just vanilla or just chocolate. People can't go, you didn't ask me before you bought this whether I like chocolate. Yeah. So like even we've done tons of them. We've done like pineapple cakes and cherry cakes and coconut ones, which taste amazing, but people won't try them because they want the standard stuff. It doesn't mean we stop doing it. It just means that.
See, coconut's all right.
Yeah.
Pineapple and what was the other one you said?
Cherry. Cherry's a bad example because Australians do like cherry flavored, like Black Forest type things. They are used to it.
But there's a specific style, I think, or flavor for the Black Forest. Like you got to do it well.
Yeah.
Like otherwise there's no point.
But it's something you have to, like for example, with the big Italian background here is tiramisu is a really popular flavor.
Oh yeah.
Like whereas I would say it's not as much in England. And same, so I would say the same thing maybe with coconut.
Like yeah, coconut's good.
Apart from a bounty,
yeah.
What else do people really have? I mean, that's a bad example in Australia because you have things like Lamingtons and stuff. But in England, only really the bounty chocolate bar has coconut in it. People are not really so exposed and it's not as common a popular flavor. But that reminds me, we have a Lamington flavor cookie coming out soon.
Hey!
Yeah. We have all the, like, we have a lot of fun making cookies and they do taste really good. But we can't bring out too much.
Ice cream flavored.
What? Okay, well, what is ice cream flavored?
Oh, that's a good question.
Yeah, right?
So when I think of ice cream, like the best ice cream I've ever had has to be Ben & Jerry's.
But which flavor? Cookie dough?
No, it's actually the caramel one.
Yeah. So that would just be a caramel cookie. You just like caramel.
But like I said.
I think like a, potentially an ice cream one, but like a, we were thinking of trying one, a Neapolitana.
Yeah, yeah, right.
Yeah, you know, where it's, but yeah. that's really so, just chocolate, strawberry, vanilla somehow. But that one's hard because that one comes out really messy as a flavor. People, you don't know what to expect.
Yeah.
But
that's hard.
Yeah.
I'll think about it and get back to you. But I got one more question for you.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
This is my legacy question.
Yeah.
That I don't think I asked you the last time I was here.
Yeah.
But your friends have put together a film for you of everything you've ever said and everything you've ever done. Oh. And they're showing it to you on your 100th birthday. What do you want that film to say and to show about your life?
That we actually created things. We actually built and made things that people got to enjoy. Like, it doesn't really matter whose face is on it. Like I said, this is not just me. There's like four of us who do this, who've built all of this together. But yeah, just the fact, because I used to do all tech startup type stuff, but that never really got to meet any customers, never really got to speak to people. It always felt like it was all happening online. So I spent like 2 years after uni doing that. But I liked hospitality and seeing people come in and enjoy it. You can just stand in the background or be washing dishes or something and just know that everyone's experiencing stuff. So probably like some sort of video. It's just like a flash of, I prefer the idea that people already love the brands and already love the products. And then people say, it literally happened today. Someone was at Banksia trying to sell us something. And then he was like, oh my God, are those thick cookies? Like, is that real thick or have you copied that? And I was like, oh no, thick cookies is also us. And he's like a massive fan of thick cookies. And it was just a moment of surprise for him. So I like that kind of thing where you just can be like,
so you're seeing the joy on people's faces. Yeah.
Just a surprise. Well, these are the things that they built. Yeah. Because you wouldn't, on that video, it would never be like, these are the cars he drove and this is the thing. So probably. And eventually, once you get more time, more charity work.
Mm.
But I already donate to charity, but actually doing the work would be eventually once things settle down. And then also, we've always maintained this as something that, I mean, there's no one here right now, but we all maintain this is what we're trying to, what we take a lot of pride from as well is all the jobs we create. Yeah. We also just talked about this the other day as well. It's like, we regret certain times when we hired a consultant when we could have hired an employee to do it and then create another job. And we always take pride in the fact that we did this and we created this many jobs, you know. So job creation as well, that would be one eventually. But no, and then also just that we lived well and are happy and a good family. It's a family business. Everyone, everyone in here is all, we're all related. In a way, like I'm married to my wife, and it's her brother. She runs a lot of the production. She runs all the production in the bakery, and her brother Josh. He runs a lot of the actual in store operations and things. And then his partner Aileen does a lot of the marketing. That's how it's all tight knit, and then all the staff members. Especially in the office, they were pretty much like family.
Yeah.
We've been working together for so long. Yeah.
So you're going to leave a thick legacy of people smiling, people enjoying themselves.
People getting thick
themselves and just living life to the best and family.
Who knows, we get more fun, interesting concepts. Great doing... doing fun things.
Love it.
They're pretty good legacy.
Love it, man.
What to say?
Well, I feel like that's a good way to sort of end that conversation.
Yeah.
Chris, thank you so much for coming on the Storybox podcast. No, it's great, man. Absolutely great. Thank you so much for your time.
Easy.
I don't like this part because it means that sadly we have come to an end of yet another incredible story. I just want to say thank you to all of you for tuning in and listening to our guest today. It is my prayer that you would have felt inspired, motivated, challenged in some way, and that you would have learned something new as well. If you'd like to hear more amazing stories like this one, you can do so now by searching up The Story Box on any podcast platform. It's that easy. If you did get something from our guest today, please share it around to a friend or family member that you think could benefit from hearing this powerful story. And before you go, please leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. It will only take 30 seconds and it'll go towards reaching more people. Let's start changing lives through powerful stories like this one. Your support is greatly appreciated. Until next time, when we dive back into the Story Box, I'm Jay Phantom, and don't forget, your story is worth more than you know. Catch you next time.